Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Stephen Pine's recent article in Scientific American is titled, "We're Living in the Pyrocene, at Our Peril." He says, today we live in a fire age in which ancient prophecies of worlds destroyed and renewed by fire has become contemporary realities, even for people living in modern cities. In the summer of 2023, millions of residents in New York City and other metropolises saw dark orange daytime skies thick with smoke by pales from Canadian wildfires and breathed in the effluent. Mythology has morphed into ecology. Stephen Pine is a fire historian, urban farmer, and emeritus professor at Arizona State University. And we'll be talking with him following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Stephen Pine's recent article in Scientific American is titled, "We're Living in the Pyrocene, at Our Peril." He says, today we live in a fire age in which ancient prophecies of worlds destroyed and renewed by fire have become contemporary realities, even for people living in modern cities. In the summer of 2023, millions of residents of New York City and other metropolises saw dark orange daytime skies thick with smoke pails from Canadian wildfires and breathed in the effluent. Mythology has morphed into ecology. Stephen Pine is a fire historian, urban farmer, and emeritus professor at Arizona State University. He spent 15 seasons with the North Rim Longshots, a fire crew at the Grand Canyon National Park. Out of those seasons emerged a scholarly interest in the history and management of fire. He's written more than 30 books. His two most recent books are Five Suns, A Fire History of Mexico, and Pyrocene Park. From 2024 and 2023, respectively. Stephen Pine, thanks for joining us on Access Utah.
Well, thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. So you're speaking to me from the Phoenix area, I believe.
Yep.
I think it occurs to me this summer, this fire season has been relatively quiet, I believe.
Yep. Yes, it has, generally. The Southwest begins to press. Well, it begins in the Southeast in the spring, and then in the Southwest, and then by July, August, it tends to move into the Northern Rockies, and perhaps Alaska. So we have a lot yet to come. I think the big uncertainty is California. It's been in a wet cycle, which is great for calming its forest fires and filling its reservoirs, but that also means that you're growing lots and lots of grass and shrubs, and those will be very amenable to burning. We're starting to see a few, but we'll have to see how the summer evolves. So there's plenty there to burn, so yeah. That could come back. So what underpins fire is a cycle of wetting and drying. It has to be wet enough to grow stuff, and then it has to be dry enough to allow that to burn. So where you have those cycles within a year, over years, you tend to have characteristic fires, and that's what we're looking at now.
So you say when you were 18, a few days after graduating high school, I'm reading from your article here, you found yourself on a forest crew at the Grand Canyon National Park. You returned for 15 seasons and became a pyromaniac, you say. So I guess you enjoyed this life. Tell me a bit about what it's like to be a hotshot firefighter.
Well, first of all, I wasn't a pyromaniac, and I'm not now. I'm a pyromantic.
Oh, I misread that. Sorry, pyromantic. Yes,
that's fine. It's an important distinction.
Yes,
we need to be careful about that. Well, I had grown up in Phoenix, basic suburb, and suddenly found myself on a forest fire crew somewhat by accident, and had no idea where I was or what I was doing, and it was kind of a real shock. I loved it. It was a extraordinary place. It was a very compelling job. It was a lot of fun. You're working at hard stuff with a gang of other like-minded folks. And because I was going to college, then later went on to grad school, I could continue to come back during the summers. And I saw no reason to quit. Usually it's a seasonal job. Fire season's a time in your life. You do it for a season, two, maybe three seasons, and then you go on. And I just didn't quit and kept at it. And then eventually, in 76, I got my doctorate and thought that I really had become quite fascinated by fire and didn't see anybody writing about it in the way that I, as a academic historian, had been trained to think about things. So I decided that would be my project, and it took several years. And eventually, I wrote a book, Fire in America, sort of a lame title, but it was a large book, and that set me on my path. And continued to write about other countries and the world. And that led to a sense that humanity and fire is a central story for both the earth and for us. And I think we have become so large that mutual assistance pact or tag team, whatever metaphor you'd care to apply, is remaking the planet. We have created the fire equivalent of an ice age. And this is, it's not just, it didn't just begin with the burning fossil fuels that gave it afterburners. It began really at the end of the last ice age when a fire wielding creature, the only one on the planet, species monopolist with regard to fire, encountered a more fire receptive Earth and began interacting. And now that's become a defining feature for the planet. And we're living with its consequences.
You point out that Earth is a fire planet, the only one we know of, I guess, because of oxygen, right? That in many ways, fire resembles a virus. How so?
Well, the Earth is the only fire planet we know because it's the only planet with life as we know it. And fire is very much a creation of the living world. I mean, life created the oxygen. But life also created and organizes the fuels. So as soon as plants began colonizing continents 420 plus million years ago, they began to burn. And they've been burning ever since. So that is really an integral feature. Even the chemistry of fire is a biochemistry. When it occurs in our cells, we call it respiration. When the same reaction occurs in the wide world, we call it fire. So it's been around for a long time. And humans, to put it very succinctly, we got small guts and big heads because we learned to cook food. And then we went to the top of the food chain because we learned to cook landscapes. And now we've become a geologic force because we're cooking the planet. So we are very much a fire creature. And we're creating a world that is more and more amenable to fire, and in ways that we didn't anticipate, and probably would like to see reformed.
You talk
So I
about
didn't get the
the
second part of your question. I
oh
lost
oh
it in my
oh oh sorry sorry the
No, that's
that that fire is like a virus.
Oh yeah. Well, it spreads by contagion. And in many ways. And it's also an interesting question whether fire is alive. And my stand has been no, it's not alive, but it is a creation of the living world and takes on properties accordingly, much like the living world. But that also, and in some ways, it reminds me of a virus. But then we get into definitions: is a virus alive or not? And that depends who you ask. And so the question whether fire is alive can't be solved by saying, well, it's like a virus, because that still leaves unresolved whether a virus is living or not. But it certainly has lots of properties. I mean, it breathes, it feeds, it moves. In many ways, the domestication of fire is a lot like tending children. You have to feed it, clean up after it. You have to train it. It's a relationship. It's not just a tool. And it requires us to behave in certain ways for it to do what we want. So.
You in the article you talk about three fires: first fire, second fire, third fire. Wonder if you take us through that, kind of looking at the scope of history, humans and fire, right? So you say first fire is nature's fire. I guess lightning strikes, and there you have it.
Right. And that's been around as long as plants have been on land. And so we have fossil charcoal 420 plus million years old. But it can be very patchy. Not every place burns every year. But nonetheless, fire has been a part of living landscapes as long as those terrestrial landscapes have been around. Second fire, is my term for the human domestication of fire, or the taming of it in some ways. Capturing fire, we didn't invent fire, it was already out there. Capturing it, using it for different purposes, and so forth. But whether for hunting, whether to promote berries, even used in fishing at night, I mean, there's just endless uses for fire. But they all occurred within this context of living landscapes. And so there are kind of ecological checks and balances. Fire had grown up with these systems. When people began changing it, there are still limits to what they can do. They can't do whatever they want. So if you want more fire, which in many ways means more power, then you have to find more stuff to burn. And this leads to third fire, which is the burning of fossil fuels, or what I think of as lithic landscapes in contrast to living landscapes. Once living, now they're buried deep in geologic time. We're taking them out, and now burning them again, and then effectively releasing their effluent into the geologic future. And what changes here are several things. One is that you're not burning fire directly on the landscape in the same way. Okay, there may be an occasional oil spill or equivalent, but we're burning them in special chambers. And so the effect of the fire is indirect. It's empowering us to make changes in how we live on the land and so forth. It also occurs outside of the old ecological checks and balances. I mean, fire had seasons. It had times in a day when it burned more vigorously than other times. But now you can burn day and night, winter, summer, wet or dry, it doesn't matter. So the old, in a sense, it's like a factory farm. You can now maximize the production of power out of combustion. We've deconstructed fire into just basic combustion now, but we don't have any place for all of its byproducts to go. And so it's not a question now of finding more stuff to burn. We've got lots and lots of stuff to burn, fossil fuels. The problem is what to do with all the effluent. And now it's overloading the atmosphere, it's overloading the oceans, and in some ways overloading the land. And we're having to deal with that. So this third fire is really a human contrivance. It would disappear if we didn't continue to sustain it. Second fire would become first fire. It would continue in different forms, but third fire would disappear. So it's up to us to create these boundaries and to manage it and to show that we've shown we can use fire to disrupt. Now we have to show we can manage it. So we're in climate management now, whether we want to think of it in those terms or not. We've certainly demonstrated we can unmoor it from its historic patterns, but we haven't demonstrated that we can actually manage it in a way that doesn't do excessive harm.
You say we're in climate management. I think many of us would nod our heads with that. Some, though, has become politicized. Some would say, no, we're not in climate management.
Well, I think to those I would respond that you're demonstrating we're not managing it. We need to manage it. We're disrupting. We're not managing. And I don't know that we can argue about that seriously. We can certainly argue over what it means and what we should do about it, but I don't know that we can argue really about the fact that change really well outside the bounds of human existence is happening, and in ways that are not altogether favorable We're not enhancing our habitat or that of others. We're really delaminating it, deranging it, and in ways that we don't really control, or we threaten. Nobody knows right now. You know, we can adapt and mitigate. We can do lots of things to sort of muddle through. At some point, I don't think anybody really knows where that point is or points, you begin changing qualitatively the whole state. So it's not like a balloon that you squeeze and it goes someplace else. You can squeeze it back. It breaks and you're in a different world. I don't know where that is, but if we continue, we will begin crossing those thresholds.
Let's take a brief break. We'll come back much more with Stephen Pine, who's a fire historian, emeritus professor at Arizona State University. And his recent article in Scientific American is titled, "We Are Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." And we'll have more following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with fire historian, emeritus professor at Arizona State University, Stephen Pine. He's written more than 30 books. The most recent books are Five Sons, A Fire History of Mexico, and Pyrocene Park. And we're talking about a recent article in Scientific American from Stephen Pine titled, "We Are Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." So, Stephen Pine, you talked about the three fires. First fire, just to remind us, is original fire, lightning strike. First fire didn't need humans, right? Second and third did and does.
Right.
So third fire is humans containing fire. You call it lithic fire, lithic landscapes. So that includes transforming things around us, right? We took fire and... you know, you create glass, you create other things, right? Interestingly, the early fire, you create steam, and that way you're able to extract fossil fuels faster. So a lot of ways the third fire transformed us, and we transformed the landscape.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, and not all of it too ill. We systematically, I mean, our world used to be filled with fires, even our houses, our offices. You needed it for light. You needed it for heat. You needed it for cooking, for all kinds of stuff. And we have now been using, the products of third fire to remake all those habitats. So in the developed world, you don't see working fires in our homes anymore. You see some still in rural areas. We do it recreationally. But basically, working fires have disappeared out of our domiciles and out of our cities. And in many ways, that's to the good. We don't have a problem with fires escaping. We don't have burning cities in the ways that they used to. We don't have to breathe smoke as much as in the past. So we have replaced all of the second fire technologies with third fire equivalents. And then we've continued to expand that beyond homes and towns into the countryside, particularly agriculture. And much of the Green Revolution, modern agriculture, is based on removing fire and the fallowing that accompanied that. You had to fallow so that you had fuel to burn for the fire. These were really fire fallow systems. And now we don't need that. We go back to our fossil biomass. We get petrochemicals for fertilizers and pesticides, herbicides, all the inputs that we add to the system to increase productivity. We put it on with machines that run fossil fuels. In effect, we found alternatives to the traditional burning that was always a kind of catalyst for agriculture, at least agriculture outside of floodplains. A few other instances where water does the stuff that fire does. So we've replaced that with very mixed results, by the way, because that's a lot of the biodiversity in agricultural systems was in the fallowing. And then we've tried to extend that into landscapes generally. And this is where we really got big problems, because taking fire out of systems in wildlands or parks, nature preserves, sort of remoter landscapes that were not intensively cultivating, had a lot of negative consequences. Fuels build up, the ecosystem dynamic becomes starts unraveling, and they have all kinds of problems. And we thought that we could replace fire in these systems by the same methods we did in our houses and cities and so forth. And that turns out to be deeply incorrect. And now that we're seeing the blowback from all of that, because these systems are now out of control in terms of wildfires, in many ways, feral fires. These were once domesticated or quasi-managed landscapes that have now gone wild because we've disrupted the old pattern of fire regimes. And so that's where we're concentrating a lot of effort now. This is one of the most visible places where we thought we could substitute third fire for second fire and first fire, and it turns out that's not true. We still have to manage fire on these landscapes and always will. And paradoxically, I think that even though eventually we will rein in our burning of fossil fuels and calm the climate, we may be able to reverse it at some point. The amount, as we ratchet down that burning, we're going to have to ratchet up the burning of living landscapes. All these other areas still need to burn. In the United States, the consequences of a fire exclusion policy became evident about 50 years after it was applied in a serious way. So if we can date sort of the modern era of American wildland fire to the fires of 1910, and for the next 50 years, led by the Forest Service, we tried to take fires out of landscapes everywhere. And some of it was just by technological substitution, this kind of third fire replacement, or the application of these machines to suppress fire. I mean, if we took away all these machines, these airplanes and engines and tankers and the rest, could we pretend to fight fire? Of course not. We would have to do what humans had always done, substitute their fires for fires they didn't want. Anyway, after about 50 years, it became apparent that this wasn't working and was making things actually worse. And the federal agencies changed their fire policies between 1968 and 1978 for the Park Service, Forest Service, and eventually the others to try to restore good fire. We took out good fire as well as bad fire. We needed to discriminate and segregate the two, trying to put it back in. So we spent 50 years trying to take all the fires out, and we've spent the last 50 years trying to put a good portion of them back in a controlled way, but conditions have changed so much that it's very difficult. So my point being that well before climate change was an issue, or even really traced in the forms that we're accustomed to now, and it becomes so obvious, we had a fire problem, and that fire problem hasn't gone away. And once we begin containing climate change, that problem is still going to be with us, perhaps even on larger scales and in ways we don't really understand. So my sense of a pyrocene, we're creating a fire age. Part of the motivation here was listening to colleagues who were alarmed that the future was not only dire, but strange. We have no narrative to connect it to the past. No analog future. We can't imagine it. And it seemed to me we had a great narrative, and it's the story of humanity and fire. And we had a great analog. We're creating the fire equivalent of an ice age. So take an ice age, the major features of an ice age, substitute fire for ice, and what does it look like? It looks like the world that we're seeing maturing before our eyes now, with climate change, biogeographical shifts, ocean sea levels changing, mass extinctions, all these things that we're part of the rhythm of the coming and going of the ice. Now we've broken that cycle, but we've replaced it with a fire age.
That is quite the comparison. Ice age, you know, incredible changes, as you just mentioned, yeah. a few of those things. So you really think that this age of the Pyrocene is on that scale?
I think it's happening, yeah. And again, it was I liked your reading of the quote about ecology. Mythology is becoming ecology. We have all these old stories from ancient times and religions, whatever, about the world ending with fire. And in many cases, it's renewed, reborn out of fire. And in a way, in a kind of slow action way, that's, I think, what is happening now. Bit by bit, we're remaking the oceans, we're remaking the atmosphere, we're remaking the terrestrial ecosystems. All of these things are being remade by fire. It's not an instantaneous twilight of the gods, and in 24 hours the earth will be burned and the world vanished and perhaps reborn or not. It's happening over decades. It's been happening for centuries, bit by bit, and now I think it's accelerating. But that's a way of imagining what we are doing. And it's not that every bit is subjected to flame, but it's being subjected to the consequences of the burning, indirectly through climate or through shifts in species and other such changes. So we are remaking the world. In some ways, we are a fire creature, a uniquely fire creature. And so this should play to our strengths. We should be able to manage fire. I mean, that's what we do that no other creature does. That's our role in the great chain of being. We just haven't been very good at it or very conscientious about it and get greedy and power hungry and decided we didn't have to manage fire in the way we had before. That, you know, it was a mutual assistance pact, and now it's looking more like a Faustian bargain. And yeah, we got a quick return out of that, but now we're dealing with the long-term consequences.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Stephen Pine. His recent article in Scientific American is titled, "We're Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." So Stephen Pine, you mentioned the Great Fires of 1910, burned 3.25 million acres in northern Idaho, western Montana, part of 5 million across the West, you write. And then you mentioned the U.S. spent 50 years trying to take all fire out of the landscapes, another 50 trying to put good fire back in. Then, you know, reference at the top of the program, you wrote about the fires in Canada last year, which I guess you could probably describe as a great fire or great fires of 2023, right? Kind of in some ways back to where we were. What are some suggested solutions you'd have us do?
Well, it's not just North America. I mean, the cycle of really extraordinary fires began in Australia, 2019-2020 season. And some of the smoke from that actually circled the planet. And then it gets picked up. California had gone through serial conflagrations during the large drought. So that Pacific Northwest, now in Canada, it looks like Canada's going to have another good season for that. It's moving around. It's moving around with these heat domes and changing conditions. Not every place is going to burn so savagely every year. It has to recover, for one thing, to rebuild itself enough to burn. But it's also the case that what comes back will come back under changed climate conditions and perhaps changed species compositions. And there's no reason to think it will come back as it was before. It will come back to something else and probably something that is more fire prone. And eventually you will be selecting for more and more fire prone. So we don't necessarily have these explosive fires, but we'll have more fires and more chronic burning. All of that is going on. So what can we do about it? Well, there are lots of things. I mean, I think the problem can be fairly simply stated. Three parts. Fire community loves triangles. So let me give you a fire triangle for today. We have too much bad fire. We have too little good fire. And then we have too much combustion overall. So what are those main bad fires? I think everybody can agree. Fires that burn towns, kill people, trash municipal watersheds. These are bad fires. We don't want them. Good fires, a little trickier to define, but they're fires basically that enhance the habitat for humans and other creatures, improve ecological goods and services, improve watersheds, enhance biodiversity, and so forth. All of these things. And part of what they do also is to dampen the likelihood of bad fires, these really explosive fires. One kind of fire is going to happen or another. And the third thing, getting combustion under control, it's our burning of lithic landscapes, our fossil fuels. Again, we can only mitigate for so long before the system really exceeds our capacity. It's beyond its elastic limits. It just sort of snaps, and I don't know where that will be, but we have to rein in our burning of fossil fuels at scale. There's really no other alternative. We can't. There's nothing that can take it out as fast as we're putting it in. And now I just saw an article. The Economist has a major feature on the age of solar power. I mean, solar power promises sort of what nuclear power was supposed to do 80 years ago, that unlimited energy, in a sense. So there are plenty of alternatives for that. But as you pointed out earlier, these also get into problems of human behavior, and which makes it political. Well, it should be political, but the politics has got to work too. And so I don't know what will happen. But those are the three things we can do and need to do to control fire. And again, even if we get climate change under control, even restore it to what it was conditions globally 50 years ago, we're still going to have huge fire problems that we had before and had not fully addressed. So that is always going to be our role. We are going to be the keeper of the planetary flame. The flames will go on without us, but we have shaped a world favorable to us and to many other creatures and species, based on our wise use of fire, and we now have to recover that capacity. We just thought we our fossil fuel powered machines were so powerful that it was a counterforce that could take on any of nature's fires and suppress them. And we're well beyond that. I mean, nature, fire in nature is integrating all of nature around it, and we don't have anywhere near that kind of capacity. And so what it means is that we can knock out all the little fires and sort of a lot of the medium scale fires. But that only creates conditions that favor larger fires. So in the end, we've taken out all the friendly fires, and we're left with the mean, nasty fires that are beyond our control. And that's not as sustainable, is an overused word. That's not a sustainable policy.
Well, let's take another break, come back with more with Stephen Pine. His recent article in Scientific American is titled, "We Are Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Stephen Pine, fire historian, emeritus professor at Arizona State University, and he's author of more than 30 books. Two most recent books are Five Sons, A Fire History of Mexico, and Pyrocene Park. You can find him at stephenpine.com. And his recent article in Scientific American, that's what we're talking about today, is titled, "We're Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." I was very interested, Stephen Pine, by your the passages in the article about our collective attitude toward second fire versus third fire, right? Second fire being fire on the landscape, third fire being what a lot of people feel, have felt, probably still feel, is the more civilized fire. We've contained fire. We've used it for our own purposes. I was interested to read Bernard Furneaux, who was head of Division of Forestry predecessor Forest Service. He said, I guess, uncontrolled fire in the landscape is a spectacle of bad habits and loose morals. And that was the attitude, I suppose.
Well, that was the attitude of professional foresters. Furneaux was our first professional forester in this country. He married an American woman and emigrated here. He had grown up in Prussia, and so he had very much the Prussian, Germanic attitude towards forestry and fire. And Central Europe, the temperate climate zone of Europe, is distinguished by not having regular wet-dry cycles. And so it has really no natural basis for fire. And so in that part of the world, all fires are the result of people creating them, creating the conditions for them, and so forth, primarily in agriculture. And so in that sense, he was right that the fire scene is an expression of society and its values and habits. And he thought the American scene was completely out of control. The European scene is well contained by cultivation. And the U.S. was not. We had fires all over the place, and very large fires. But that was the attitude of foresters. And foresters saw fire as an implacable enemy, something used at the hands of farmers and pastoralists to replace forests with pasture and fields. And generally using fire. Unfortunately, forestry became politically powerful as part of a conservation program in the 19th century. This was a global project. It was in many ways what sustainability is today. And a part of that project in the European colonial settings was creating a forest reserve, excluding people so that they couldn't use fire abusively, and then eliminating fire on this Central European model. And that turned out to be a very profound misreading of fire on the planet and the role of foresters in conservation in it. So fire control became a foundational project, and in many ways an index. Are you succeeding in protecting these areas? And they used fire as that index. So we sort of got off, had a misstep right at the beginning. Foresters in many ways were not the best ones to deal with fires. People in wildlife, people using fire for pastoralism, even agriculture, had a much closer and sensible view of humans and fire. Anyway, we were stuck with it. So, forestry has since reformed, but those old attitudes got embedded very deeply around the world. And essentially German or Franco-German forestry established itself as the norm. This is what landscapes are supposed to look like. And we will try to make the world fit our norm. And it turns out that they were the anomaly. There were very small fractions of the world are sort of intrinsically fire-free because they don't have this climatic two-cycle engine going on. But the vast majority of the world does and has extensive fires. And so it was all misread right from the beginning. Nonetheless, the last 50 years, the agents, federal agencies have been working very, very strenuously to try to get fire back in.
I'll talk about a couple of images, powerful images from your article. One that I haven't seen these images, but you brought these into my mind. You say the Earth is dividing into two realms of combustion. You know, some parts of the world second fire, some third fire. One great example, you say, is take a look at satellite images of the two Koreas at night.
Yeah, well, you can see this part of it very simply. International Space Station has plenty of images. And you look at that part of the world, and South Korea is ablaze in lights. These are evening photos. China and Russia on the other side of North Korea, lots of illumination. And then North Korea is essentially a dark zone. The capital has some, very little otherwise. But then if you flip to a daytime hotspot images, say by the MODIS satellite, which is how we record a lot, you will see lots and lots at the right time of the year, particularly in the spring, you'll see lots and lots of fires burning, almost completely contained by the political entity that is North Korea. And this is an interesting case of a peninsula, common heritage, common history, people, et cetera, divided by the war. And one makes this transition to a kind of third fire civilization, and one doesn't. And there it is, illuminated. You have one or the other. And you can see lots of these Earth at night satellite images. Usually they focus on cities, electric lights. But if you get you can also get the living landscape lights. Africa and Europe makes a great contrast. That's what I used in the talk and have used elsewhere, and it's quite striking. Sub-Saharan Africa, so much of it is all in living landscapes, with a few patches for large cities, where you see it's converted. And then Europe, almost all of it, electrified. Now, not all of that is the result of combustion. I mean, France has a big nuclear program, hydropower. There are other sources of electricity, and now new stuff is coming into play. But it's essentially a third fire civilization. It was created under those conditions. And in the European model outside the Mediterranean's its own fire zone, but outside of that, the European sense that, as Furneaux put it, that wildfires were the result of bad behavior, has proved true. Where are most of the fires today? In Europe, they're in Ukraine, they're in the battle zones, and you can see, I just saw an image recently on from northern Israel, Lebanon border, and you can see essentially this is where the fires are. So fires accompany wherever social breakdown occurs in cultivated landscapes, then that's where wildfires break out. So that it was not irrational. It was just applied inappropriately to other settings where it didn't make sense. So, like most of us, they took their own, the world they grew up as normative. This is how it's supposed to be. And they would try to apply that. Of course, this is universal. And they thought that they were speaking with the transcendent conclusions and principles of modern science. Well, there was no fire science then. I mean, nobody studied it at that point. It had disappeared. Had gone into mechanical engineering and combustion chemistry and so forth, but fire in the landscape, nobody was studying that. So they really didn't have science behind them. What they had were their collective opinions and shared values and perceptions of a group of this guild of foresters who saw fire as an enemy and something that needed to be contained. So we got started on the wrong foot. Since then, we're creating a fire science. We also lost all that traditional knowledge was part of it. And a lot now there's a lot of interest in recovering cultural burning by tribal groups, indigenous peoples who also see it as part of a protest, a decolonizing project. But we shouldn't restrict it just to indigenous peoples, because Europeans had plenty of fire in their history. It's all over the place. But it was embedded in agriculture. And when fire science started being funded, it was for these protected reserves and parks. So it was nominally wildlands. So it excluded agricultural burning. That didn't seem, we want to know how nature works. And in fact, agriculture is applied fire ecology in many cases. So they really misread that, and we're still dealing with the consequences of how our fire science got. But my point being that there was a lot of traditional knowledge, and the quarrel was really not so much, was really a quarrel between elites and people who were actually living on the ground who needed it. And both sides got aspects of it right and got aspects wrong. But there it was impossible almost to talk between them. It was just fire. We can't discriminate. We can't have nuanced discussions about fire. We just have to exclude it. People won't understand. are they going to distinguish between good and bad fire? Who makes that decision? Let's just ban it, and we have the power to enforce that ban, and then maybe later at some other time we can work it out if we want to. And that sort of categorical decision turned out to be very damaging. There should have been a discussion, a sort of ongoing conversation about how we manage fires. And it really began, again, going back to 1910, these large fires that traumatized the Forest Service and sent us on our path. That same month in Northern California, there was a discussion called the light burning controversy, which argued that we should really not be trying to fight all these fires. We should be emulating the American Indian and routinely burning the understory of these forests, particularly in these montane pineries and the rest, and that would protect against large fires. And that discussion was, there it was, and it was split right from the beginning. We're talking about it. How do we interpret that? So I think now almost all observers wish we had taken the other side on that controversy, which in effect we have. But had we done it earlier, we would still have problems, but we would not have this same kind of deeply rooted problems that we've created for ourselves.
We've
I'm
been,
sorry, you should just tell me time out.
No, it's all.
I just keep going on and on.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. Appreciate it very much. We have reached the end of our time here. Stephen Pine's recent article in Scientific American is titled "We're Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." You can find him at stephenpine.com, and his two most recent books are Five Suns: A Fire History of Mexico and Pyrocene Park. You find many other books of his as well. Stephen Pine, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And enjoy the rest of your day.
Okay, you too. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll go out as we do on Tuesdays with Utah StoryCorps. Thanks, everyone.
It's time again for Utah StoryCorps. Everyday people sharing their stories at the StoryCorps recording booth in Logan.
My name is Jason Kimber. I am interviewing my longtime friend.
I'm David Simmons. I grew up in Providence, Utah. This valley has grown a ton since I've been here. And back when I grew up, pretty much out at 1400 North, it ended. And until you got to Smithfield. And my parents are from here. My grandparents are from here.
Can I use the term Cache Valley royalty with some of your grandparents?
Yeah, my grandpa Stratford Loosley was a teacher in Skyview High School. If you're familiar with Cache Valley area, in the middle is Logan City, and they have their own little school district and Logan High School. It's like a donut hole, and Everything out around it is Cache County. Everybody that didn't live in Logan went to Skyview High School. People knew who Grandpa was, and you know, some people might know Michael Ballum and Craig Jessup, those guys. He taught them, and Grandpa directed all the musicals and something called the Front Porch Majority. We used to go to every production that Grandpa put on. It was a big deal. They did records, like vinyl.
Really?
Smithfield still has an award that they give every year that is to a young musician, and I think they call it the B. Stratford Loosley Award.
I love that.
He was a special, special man. The other side of my family grew up musical as well. My grandpa Simmons played the trombone in the community band. He was on the float in the different parades. My dad and his brothers had a little singing group called the Simmons Brothers. They'd go and do programs all over the place. And I'm sure what my dad and his brothers were able to earn got us through a lot of Christmases.
I'm familiar with your childhood home. And where you live, there's some big hills.
Oh, boy. Before I was old enough to ride a bike, Dave Webb and I would ride our big wheels everywhere. I remember putting tube socks on my arms and pretending to be Chips Patrol. I mean, you have to have gloves in the Chips Patrol. So we would ride around and we'd bash into each other. We'd get up on top of like somebody else's driveway that happened to have a little hill to it. And we'd go down and we'd pretend like we're sideswiping one another. And the neighborhood seemed to have all sorts of dogs. And you would know, oh no, Chuck Singleton's out. Get in the house.
But wait, we need to clarify. Chuck Singleton is a dog.
Yes, Chuck's a dog. And they all had last names. There were Newbie Toon, Nikki Branchley, Cotton Butters. I remember opening the door one time and Chuck Singleton was in my garage.
Okay.
Scared me to death. That door went closed. And I'm like, hey, Chuck's in the garage. Stay in the house. Cotton Butters was tiny, but would come after you. If you ride your bike by that house, Cotton Butters is chasing you down and nipping at your heels. and we started getting into bikes. You keep your legs up while you ride. Last day of kindergarten, me and David Webb are like, we're going to ride our bikes to school. So that makes us what, six? We were known as the Davids. David Webb was always a little more adventurous than me. He grew faster, he was bigger, he was stronger. He was going to be further ahead of me. And so we're cruising and we get to the hill. We're not going down Eck Hill. Let's not be crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Plus, there was a dog right at the beginning of Eck Hill, so you better be moving.
Yeah.
We go a curvy route. And my little spaghetti arms start to maneuver back and forth. I'm losing control, and they start going faster. And I'm going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Boom. The whole thing turns, and little David launches over these handlebars. And I was a hamburger bloody mess.
Oh, buddy.
So David Webb, out there in front of me, he rides back to me. And the one thing I remember him saying is, well, we got to keep going to school. So we finish the ride down to school, and I stumble into Miss Purser's class. A bloody mess.
Oh, what a way to go out on kindergarten.
We live in a bit of a different world. If we rode down to the Country Shopper, which was down off the hill too, we'd just say we're going to buy some baseball cards, and it was okay. Now we'd probably have to think about it and schedule a play date or something.
That's what happens from growing up in a small town.
And this is Utah StoryCorps. Thank you for coming along. Support for Logan StoryCorps comes from Cache County and from USU Credit Union, a division of Golden West.